we like to tell people that our food is healing. When my grandmother eats traditional foods, she closes her eyes and talks about her childhood days.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Vitalist Spark podcast. I'm your host, John Ford, and we're back for episode 2 in our mini-series of mini-sodes featuring recently awarded 2018 innovation grants. Throughout this series, our purpose is to go beyond that single paragraph in the press release and really get a feel for the great work that's underway in our communities, thanks to time generously given when our new partners stopped by the Vitalist Spark Studios. Our promise to you? You'll learn about exciting projects and meet incredible people, and it'll all happen in about the space of your daily commute. So let's get to it. Mini-series episode 2 focuses on food sovereignty for the White Mountain Apache tribe. I'm your host, John Ford, and today we have a very, very special guest with us. I can't even begin to tell you all the great things that you're going to hear today, but suffice it to say, there are some incredible moments that we're going to experience walking in the shoes of an incredible person, that we're going to learn about the growth of an entire farm from just a small 10 by 20 plot. We're going to be talking about hunting and gathering and wild grasses and acorn stew, and it's going to be amazing. So let's just get started with it right now. Let me introduce you to Mr. Clayton Harvey. Clayton, how are you today?
I'm doing great. She Clayton Harvey once there. In Desen, in Lee, Dunkers, yet Unisha. Greetings, my name is Clayton Harvey. I am of the Ndezen people. That's my clan. That's how I identify myself as an Apache.
What is the People's Farm, number one? And number two, how do you properly say the People's Farm in Apache?
So the People's Farm is a community-oriented farm. Our focus is providing fresh quality produce to our community, addressing the chronic illnesses that our people are dealing with, diabetes, heart failure, kidney failure, and using that farmland as a way of healing and an opportunity to re-educate and revitalize our food systems that have been lost, and nurturing and fostering young Apache farmers so that they can be instilled with this ancestral knowledge so that they can in turn teach other tribal members, and therefore spreading that knowledge to our community members with hopes that we're able to start a movement and to be able to revitalize that food system. And the proper way to say the People's Farm in Apache is Nde Bikia. So Nde is basically how we would say the people. And Bikia, B is theirs, and Kia is farm. So it's the people's farm.
Nde Bikia.
Yes. Yeah.
How long has Nde Bikia been in operation? What's the history?
Excuse me. So Nde Bikia was started in about 2010. When our tribe was mitigating our water rights and looking into water development, there was an existing farm that was established in the 1980s, and it was mostly animal feed, hay, barley, oats, grains. And because of mismanagement and politics, it dwindled down to a field of weeds. And so our boss targeted that area in hopes to rebirth that farm and start growing alfalfa and hay. But somewhere along the way, they were introduced into fruits and vegetables. And they started on a really small plot. I remember it was like a 10 by 20 plot. It was really tiny. And I remember going to the river and filling up buckets of water and splashing water on the plants. And that year proved that they can grow fruits and vegetables at the farm. And so the following year, they established the Nde Bikia, the garden. And I tell people that we're cornfield people. My grandmother shared with me that when our clan would go from our winter home to our summer home, we would stop in the middle and we would plant our fields and we would leave We weren't there to water, to pull weeds, to tend to the fields. We'll let Mother Nature take care of that. So when Ndebe Kia started, we had to take classes on how to grow, how to farm, how to garden, how to improve our soils, how to build, those healthy soils so that we can have healthy plants, and how to start seeds. And it was just a whole new area that we weren't very knowledgeable in, and it was quite exciting to learn these things, to sit in a school setting and learn how to grow food.
Where did you get that learning from? Who came in and gave that instruction?
So we have a local community college, which is the Northland Pioneer College, which provides a small component of agriculture classes, and so we were able to tap into that resource.
So 2010, small plot, getting water, literally carrying water to the plot. How does that go from there to where we are today?
I'm going to start crying. It's very emotional, the birth of this farm to where we are now. Within the past 7-8 years, the farm has grown quite extensively. I mentioned going to the river and filling up buckets of water and hauling water and splashing water on the plants to where now we turn on a switch and irrigation is pumped from a well and irrigated across the road and into our garden, and fields are watered by drip irrigation. And that shows how far we've gone from hauling buckets to turning on a switch and irrigating water. Along the way, we've developed quite an extensive relationship with our community. Without the community's support, within their buy-in, their input, this farm would not be where it is today. We strongly rely on the community's support. We host a series of farm classes provided to the community in hopes to train and to nurture farmers. And we also run a farmers market, which runs from mid-May all the way to the end of September, depending on when our last freeze is. We also were able to develop a passive solar greenhouse. Passive solar meaning that there's no outside source power in this greenhouse. It's all solar. And so we're able to build that greenhouse on the farm and to start seedlings in that greenhouse in the spring, and then in turn selling seedlings to the community. Again, back to fostering and nurturing our farmers and providing them that resource. And then also whatever, we don't sell, it all goes back into the garden. And that's how our produce is grown. And we've also had developed a building an orchard. Historically, there were orchards all along our rivers, but because of the boarding school era within our reservation and our grandparents being taken from the homes and not very many people to tend to these orchards, they died. And so as a part of revitalizing our farming, we incorporated an orchard. And we have 120 trees grown in our orchard, anywhere from peaches to apples and cherries and plums and apricots. And so we've also built two hoop houses. And these hoop houses are tunnel-like structures. They're able to help us to extend our season. And what I mean by extending our season is growing earlier in the year and later within the year. And so the farm has been in operation year-round for the past 5 years, I believe, and really emphasizing in the cold season, looking at the cool season crops like cabbages and leafy greens and all the root crops.
So from one 10 by 20 plot, you now have a year-round farm. How many, do we measure this in acres?
It's about 6 acres.
6 acres?
Including the orchard and the cornfields plus the garden.
All right, so 6 acres with 120 trees, the greenhouses, the hoop houses. It's amazing. Absolutely incredible. How does that happen? How did it develop so quickly? And I know you said it was about the community. Where was the funding? Where was the development?
The development, the funding was provided by foundations, being able to build and to prove ourselves to these foundations and showing them that the work is valued you know, we're not, our work is not in vain. You know, our community honors what we're doing. And we work closely with the First Nations Develop Institute, and they specialize in working with tribes who are trying to revitalize their food systems. And so we were able to network with them and to build a relationship with them to where they're able to provide funding for us. And so our startup funds mostly came from the First Nations Institute.
Up until now, mostly national funding, is that correct?
Yeah, and we have our tribe provides the salary portion for us, and so we're able to use that and to compensate with foundations, with grants. With our tribe has a land restoration funding opportunity where anyone who has a proposal in restoring land can be awarded money, and so we're we sought those funds and were able to gain those funds. And so in 2013, I believe, the Ndebikia became the first tribally owned farm, I believe, in the state, if not in the country, to be USDA certified through the GAP certification, the Good Agricultural Certification, and basically meaning that we're taking every measure to prevent any type of contamination or foodborne illnesses by making sure that our workers are healthy and fit for duty, that we're sanitizing and disinfecting all of our food contact services, all of our bins, all of our harvesting tools, and just really doing it in a very clean sanitary practice. And so we've been awarded that. And so it's been quite a journey in that, a lot of documentation, a lot of just a lot of paperwork involved in that.
It's okay to say it was a pain in the ass.
Yeah, it was a pain. It was a pain. And our dream, which comes to now, you know, our dream was always to develop our own policy within our own tribe, to where the government's not dictating and telling us what to do, but we can develop our own policies and we can go to the schools and tell them that, you know, that we have certifications, you know, that because the GAP certification, it's great, you know, it was able to open, you know, the way and help us to get on track when it comes to food safety. But there's a lot of cons to that. Mm-hmm. We call ourselves the People's Farm, yet we have this certification that does not allow people into the garden unless they go through this certification. So that in itself builds a barrier between our community and the farm. And so we've kind of, we cringe, you know, when people come and we have to turn them away. But lately we've been able to do small, really quick food safety trainings and have schools come and do tours on the farm. And so, again, you know, the cons, you know, if a family wants to steam their Indian corn underground and sell it to a industrial kitchen, they're not able to because GAP does not allow it to, because they don't understand, mm-hmm. you know, that our people have been doing this since time immemorial, and we have never heard of any type of foodborne illness happen within that time. And so it's like, you know, you're going to tell my grandmother, who's been practicing this art since she was a child, that she can't.
It's not safe.
Yeah, yeah. And who are you to say that? You know?
So this brings us to the present, truly.
Yes, yes.
And where we were lucky enough to meet you, where Vitalist was lucky enough to come into contact with you, was over the grant, over this current grant, to try and help change that.
Yes.
To allow the tribes to practice self-determination, to allow tribes to hopefully more than one tribe, but certainly yes. At this point, White Mountain Apache, to help get cultural practices back into the system. To allow for that possibility, and so talk a little bit about how you see the grant unfolding and how quickly can we right this wrong.
Well, I see the grant unfolding right now. We've announced the position within the tribe, and we've got about 6 applicants that have applied. Very strong applicants. I see a lot of potential in that, and where we see the grant unfolding is looking at the community, asking the community what they want, what they need, because this grant is for the community. It's for the people. Like you said, you know, practicing our self-determination, you know, so that we're able, our own sovereignty. You know, how can we say we're sovereign if we're not going to practice that sovereignty? Mm-hmm. And so using that sovereignty and writing these policies so that someone who wants to steam corn underground, or somebody who wants to steam meat underground, or to sell wild game that was hunted to schools, and developing step-by-step practices so that our community is not overwhelmed, but our community is knowledgeable in that they're provided these resources. Our whole deal is to market our traditional foods, and using that as a means, because I tell people that not everyone on the reservation is meant to leave and to go off and get an education. And there are some people who want to stay at home, people who want to live there, people who want to just make a living there, and they just don't know how. And this will give them that opportunity. Currently, our unemployment rate is staggering. It's about 80%, and that's very high.
Wow.
And by developing these policies and introducing this to the community and allowing our people to make a living off of this, this will reverse that number enormously. And we have the land, we have the water, so why not? And how we're going to market these things is we're going to be working closely with Café Cujo, which is run and operated by the Rainbow Treatment Center. And the head chef, Nephi Craig, he's going to be purchasing a lot of these produce and offering it within his kitchen. We like to tell people that our food is healing. When my grandmother eats traditional foods, she closes her eyes and talk about her childhood days. And a lot of times our elders aren't able to go out and to farm and to do these things. And so by you know, obtaining the certification, you know, we have an elderly kitchen that serves meals to our elders that are homebound. And so this will give them the opportunity to come back and to taste ancestral foods and to build up on that. We're working on a well-established relationship with Chef Nephi Craig. And also, you know, working with the University of Arkansas, you know, they have the Indigenous Food Initiative going there, and they're offering trainings on FSMA, which is the Food Safety Modernization Act. And so we're going to be working closely with them when developing these policies, and also working with the FDA, you know, so that when we do write these policies, that it's all our T's are crossed, our I's are dotted, and that everything is worded so that when a inspector comes, you know, we could show them our certifications and say, you know, it is FDA approved, you know, and we do have these protocols in place and we are following them.
So how hard is it or frustrating is it to reclaim tribal self-determination within a Western frame like that?
I think if we have the right people in place, we have...
Do you see a willingness from places like USDA in helping to make this happen, or do you see a resistance?
I feel a resistance on their part just because... They have their GAP certification, and they don't fully understand how we prepare our foods.
And they can't step out of that
zone. No, they can't.
Okay.
And they don't have that relationship with tribes. That's the thing. That's the barrier with that. They don't have direct contact or relationship with tribes. They don't ask the tribes what they want. They're basically dictating the tribes on what to do.
You know, you told a really beautiful story about elders reconnecting to themselves, to their history, to their past, simply by being able to eat ancestral foods. Like with any of us, there's this memory that gets triggered immediately. Mm-hmm. And I think just about anybody could relate to that. And so I hope that we can find the right people within the USDA and other agencies that can come to understand that, and through that understanding can sort of step out of their box and help make new rules. I think that's really what the heart of this grant is about,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yes, yes, it definitely is. And also, like you said, you know, developing that relationship with them that was never there. And so it's going to be a lot of hard work.
Do you have representatives in Arizona that you're working with from these agencies?
We have the Department of Agriculture that we're working with, and they're the ones that do the gap audits on the farm. And so they're based out of Yuma. And so, yeah, we do have that. We do currently have relationships with them.
All right. We're going to send this podcast to them. Now, just to be clear, I want to make sure we don't lose this, too. This is not just about farmed foods. This is also about hunting foods.
Hunting and gathering.
And gathering foods as well, yeah.
Yes, the Apache food system. So we, over, you know, since we arrived here in this area, you know, anthropologists tell us that we arrived here in about 1400. Since then, we've developed a complex food system, which not only involves, you know, the hunters and gatherers, you know, but, you know, watching the animals and what they eat, you know, identifying with them. Our popular food that people harvest in right now, which is ready, is acorn. And it's not just any acorn tree that we pick. It's an emery acorn tree. And the significant thing about the emery acorn tree is that it only grows in Apache territory, Western Apache territory. And you look at tribes in the East and other tribes in like the Northwest, and when they make their acorn stews, they have to leach their acorn. But we don't. Our acorns don't have that chemical that other acorns do. That's what's very significant and very what I like about it. You know, we call ourselves the acorn people, and so we also collect pinyons. And one thing that we're being reintroduced to is wild grains. So a lot of these grasses we look outside, you know, we see them as weeds. But historically, our people would pick these grains and they would sort of use it as wild rice. They would also use it as flour. And so right now we're working with the Western Apache food diet. And what they're working on is something called the pre-res diet. And so identifying not only, you know, what we've hunted and gathered today, but historically, you know, things that have been lost. A lot of seasonal plants like grasses and nuts and juniper berries and roots and tree barks, you know, all these, you know, foods that we just walk by, we don't really recognize them. And when we were started working with these folks, they gave us a list of about 1,000 wild foods, and they told us that historically, by the time a child was 8 years old, they would know every single plant on that list and where to gather it, how to gather it, when it was ready, how to prepare it. And I was looking at that list, and I was about 30 years old at the time, and I was like, I can only identify two or three of these. And here I am telling people I could survive, you know, 200 years ago, you know. Yet I looked at that list and I'm like, there's no way, you know, I would be able to survive, you know. And, you know, not only are we working with those people, but also our hunters. We hunt mule deer and white-tailed deer. And those are sacred to the Apache people. And we don't just go out and hunt. We do it in a very relevant and respectful way. We do everything in prayer. We give thanks before we go out and hunt. We give thanks when the hunt is killed. We do a prayer for that and giving thanks to it. We, before anything is butchered or gutted, you know, that prayer has to be done, and it has to, and then the butchering has to be done in a certain way, so that, you know, we're respectful of the animal and thanking the animal for giving us food and giving their life for us.
Take us forward 3 to 5 years. What do you think the impact will be? How many people can be touched? And by the way, how soon can we have acorn stew?
So acorn stew, I'm sure that we could work something out to where we can bring a pot of acorn stew down and share with our friends down here.
Excellent. Or we'll come to the cafe if you'll let us.
Yes, of course. And so the first year we hope to engage about 30 families in working with this and working with them and helping them to understand this is a food safety policy, you know, that they have to adhere by these policies and training these people. And so in about 3 or 4 years, I envision, you know, the farm, there is farmland that has been sitting in idle for decades. And since I've started working at that farm, not very many families have been farming around the area. So I see farmland being utilized within the next 5 years. I see our water being utilized. I see us taking advantage of our resources that are available for us by this grant and developing these policies will open doors to families to be self-sustaining, to be self-sufficient, to where they can actually say, I am a business owner. I develop a business plan. And I sell my traditional foods in industrial settings, and I make a living off of this. How awesome, you know.
So awesome.
Will that be? It's going to pave the way, not only for the White Mountain Apache tribe, but I believe that through the partnership with the Vitalist Foundation in developing our policies, that we will be mentoring other tribes, that other tribes will come to us and look to us and ask us for consultations.
We are very, very excited to be partners with you in this. And I should also mention that this grant is being co-funded by the Narba Institute, and we couldn't be more grateful for the connection we have been able to make with you and with everybody who's involved with the farm and with the cafe. It's just an incredible project. And we have the same feeling as you, is this whole notion of being able to develop self-sustaining future, to be able to do a little bit of economic development, to take those lessons and those wins that are established with USDA and take them potentially to other tribes. It's all incredibly, incredibly exciting. It really is. We couldn't be more thrilled to be working with you. So thank you for opening your doors to us. We really appreciate it.
Yes. You know, it's amazing how things can fall together and fall into place. It's like the stars aligned and the universe was right there and giving it to us, you know. And it's an honor, it's a blessing to have another outside organization see the potential of this farm, to be able to fund us and to give us this opportunity. It's an honor, and we're very grateful. Very grateful. In Apache, we say Bahansi. Bahansi is within my heart. I am beyond grateful. No words can explain how I feel. So right now, it's like all Bahansi. You know, I. That's all I can say is Bahansi. You know, I can't explain the feeling. You know, today I can't say I'm more prouder to say that I'm White Mountain Apache, that I am an Apache farmer, that I carry with me ancestral knowledge that was passed down generation to generation to generation. In 2018, I can stand here in Phoenix, Arizona, in downtown on the 15th floor and say that I am a White Mountain Apache farmer. That I'm proud of. That, you know, that's my passion. That's who I am.
Thank you so much, Clayton, for taking the time to talk with us at the Vitalist Spark. More importantly, thank you for your foundational work, literally carrying the water to help make the People's Farm a reality and dedicating yourself to food sovereignty goals that improve tribal health and well-being. That's it for this mini-sode mini-series episode 2. Stay tuned. Episode 3, featuring the ACLU's Demand to Learn effort, is headed your way next. To make sure you get it, reach into your podcast app right now and subscribe to the Vitalist Spark. As always, remember this: with great responsibility comes great power. We'll see you back on the road to well-being soon.